We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
PR News, I'm Kathleen McLaughlin in Beijing.
A new study finds that training soldiers who are not medics to administer first aid on the battlefield can prevent a number of deaths. About 90% of combat-related deaths occur before troops reach a medical facility. A regiment of Army Rangers was trained to do basic first aid, including the use of tourniquets to stop bleeding. Significantly fewer Rangers from that unit died from wounds compared to all troops in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan over the study period. Dr. Russ Cotwall is with the Army's Special Operations Command.
If I teach that soldier to put on a tourniquet himself, or if I teach his buddy that's standing right next to him to put on a tourniquet himself and do that very quickly, then the chances are that he does not need as much resuscitation from me by the time he comes to me.
The study recommends that all soldiers be given medical supplies and basic medical training. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge and American Concierge magazines. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and a business and shopping guide. Concierge magazines are distributed throughout Central Illinois and always present the Champaign-Urbana and Bloomington-Normal areas at their best.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Over the past 9 months, a wave of political protest has swept through North Africa and the Middle East. In Tunisia and Egypt, governments have fallen, but elsewhere, rulers have met demands for change with deadly force. In this hour of Focus, we'll be trying to get an update on this movement that has been called by some the Arab Spring. And our guest for the program is Robert Malley. He is the program director for the Middle East and North Africa for the International Crisis Group based in Washington, D.C. He directs analysts based in Amman, Cairo, Beirut, Tel Aviv, and Baghdad. And together they report on political, social, and economic factors affecting the risk of conflict and then make policy recommendations to address those threats. We'll be talking with him and would be very happy to take questions and comments from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief and on target with their questions, but you're welcome to join in the conversation. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, you may do that as well, will-talk@illinois.edu. Just a little bit more background on our guest, Dr. Robert Malley. Before going to work at the Crisis Group, he worked in government. He was the Director for Democracy, Human Rights, and Humanitarian Affairs at the National Security Council. This was in the mid-90s. Then he went on to serve as the Executive Assistant to Sandy Berger, the National Security Advisor, and also he served as Special Assistant to President Clinton for Arab-Israeli Affairs. That's from 1998 until 2001. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And Dr. Malley, hello.
Yes, hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. The events that we're talking about here began say late last year, and then extended into this year. And at the beginning, it seemed that there was great optimism, or at least there was a lot of hope about the potential for change. And certainly, there were dramatic events that led to the downfall of two long-serving rulers in Tunisia and in Egypt. Now it seems that people there in Tunisia and in Egypt are pretty disillusioned about little else having changed. We've got a really vicious crackdown against dissent in Syria. We've got a civil war in Libya, and we have other places where nascent movements just seem to have dwindled. So I guess the place to begin is to try to talk about where we are now in this. And how to, perhaps understand not only what's happened, but where you think things are going.
Well, I think you set it up exactly right, which is to look back at first at what happened in those months, January, February, where everything looked almost too perfect. And I think historians will look back at it and say the pristine moment of the Arab Revolution was Tunisia and Egypt. Mm. Those were nonviolent. They were entirely peaceful. They were entirely spontaneous. They were clear. They were enthusiastic. They were very hopeful. They were very quick. And they were very surprising. And so leaders were taken aback by what swept them from office in ways that they never expected. They were not prepared for what their people did to them. And I think what's happened since has been messier, not just in Egypt and Tunisia, where, as you say, there is, as always after revolutions, great disenchantment and great disillusionment, even though not all hope is over. But even more messy, it's what's happening throughout the region, in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Libya, and, of course, in Syria. And I think what's happened, number one, is that regimes are now prepared for what's coming, and they've learned how to react, if in a very bloody way, to these popular uprisings. And divisions have appeared among the opposition. Violence has entered the fray. There's been foreign intervention, which was completely absent in Egypt and Tunisia, but is now present in almost all the other theaters that we're talking about. And so what began as almost a pristine moment in the history of the Arab world has not ended. I mean, I still think there's quite a lot of hope, but it looks much messier, much more dangerous, much more bloody, much more violent, and much more uncertain about what the ultimate outcome will be.
Yeah. I'd certainly think that it's worth looking at, or one should look at, the role that the existing elites in the country played in what happened. And the thing that I keep coming back to, and seems that the more I look at it, the more it keeps coming up again and again, is the role that militaries have played. Mm-hmm. In so many places, really, I think one could argue that a big reason for the fall of the governments or of the leaders, the presidents in Tunisia and Egypt, was that their militaries turned against them. Bashar Assad is hanging on because his military is with him. In Yemen, there's kind of a stalemate because the military is split. It seems that sector in every country seems to be the deciding party.
I think you're right again. That is the swing vote, and you just set it out in terms of, if you look at how the military has reacted in different countries, you'd almost divine where the country will go. When it quickly either sides with the protesters or takes a neutral stance, but certainly doesn't come to the defense of the regime, then the regimes tend to fall, as in Egypt and in Tunisia, where they either take an offensive sort of an offensive stance against the protesters, as they're now doing in Syria, or where they divide and split, as in Yemen and in Libya, then you either have stalemate or you have bloodshed. And one of the reasons, it's not simply is the military, you know, where it wakes up on a certain morning, what does it want to do? It really reflects the nature of the militaries and of the armies and the security services in these different countries. In a country like Egypt or like Tunisia, where the military is an institution of the state that pre-exists and can survive the advent and the fall of the regime. President Mubarak was in power, but the military is the one that installed Mubarak there, and the military is continuing in its role even after Mubarak fell. That won't be the case in Libya. It wouldn't be the case in Syria, because the military and the regime are so closely intertwined that if the regime falls, it's going to be very hard for the heads of the army, the heads of the security services, to survive. There is not that distinction between a traditional, old state institutions on the one hand, the bureaucracy, the military, the judiciary, and the regime on the other. In a country like Libya, in a country like Syria, the two have become one, and therefore it's much harder for the military to either take a neutral stance or to take the side of the protesters.
Yeah. The one, I think, you know, certainly one of the distinguishing features of what has happened is that, at least initially, that largely this was the people who were opposing the government, this was nonviolent political action. And really the only place, I think, it's true that essentially the only place that opponents of the government took up arms was Libya. And so that's why we have the civil war there and not something else. Then one would wonder what for the opponents of governments who really are interested in pushing change, and also for working for what they consider to be the interests of of common people and of working people, what sort of levers do they actually have, or do they have any?
Well, I mean, the first point to make is that Egypt and Tunisia were remarkably nonviolent, remarkably peaceful, even in the face, 800 people, we tend to forget it, but 800 people were killed in Egypt. That's a pretty high number, not as high as in other places, but it's still significant. And even in the face of that kind of repression, people remain peaceful. That's the resilience of peaceful demonstrators is perhaps the most important lesson of what's happened so far. That's not really held up elsewhere. I mean, you're right that Libya is the clearest-cut case where protesters quickly took up arms, but there's incidents of violence in Syria. It's much murkier, but there's some evidence that some groups of protesters have taken up arms. Likewise in Yemen, and that it's in many ways that serves the interests of the regime because regimes don't know how to deal with nonviolent protest. I mean, if you ask them for leverage, the greatest leverage is to having people come out day in, day out, blocking the economy, blocking normal life, but doing it in ways that are peaceful, nonviolent, and that encompass as large a segment of the population as possible. Once they resort to weapons, they move it to an arena where regimes are much more comfortable because they're much more used to dealing with it. They know how to shoot, and in fact, they believe they have stronger firepower than their opponents, not in Libya because NATO was involved, but if NATO had not been involved, the rebels would very quickly have been crushed by Gaddafi's forces. So it's the real, you ask what's the main strength, what's the main strength of the protesters? It's precisely what appears from afar as their weakness, which is the fact that they don't have weapons, they don't have firepower, they don't have a military at their disposal. But if they could remain at that level of pure civil demonstrations, mass protests, they're putting the regime in a situation that it just doesn't know how to handle. And then you see cracks emerge at the higher level of the regime, which say, we simply can't continue this way. We're losing money. The economic elites are going to abandon us if we're not prepared, if we can't ensure the stability that they're counting on. So they don't really have much leverage. I mean, they have the leverage of their resilience and of their determination to withstand brutal force. There's some international leverage, although I would be quite skeptical about the degree to which international pressure, short of military intervention, which I think is almost always a bad idea, but the international pressure in the form of sanctions or in the form of denunciation, I don't think that truly can affect the minds of leaders who are determined to remain in power at all costs. What will change their mind is when they see that they cannot subdue their peoples, and what will really change their mind is when they see that elements of the regime itself, army, security services, economic elite, intelligence services, are beginning to crack and are beginning to say, we're better off by jumping ship now than by drowning with those who are in power. Mm.
And is there a reason to be worried, though, there would be places where that people would become frustrated, those people who were maybe initially very hopeful and optimistic there would be political change, places like that, people would become frustrated and might start to think about or even turn to more violent means to try to get things moving.
Absolutely. And I suspect that part of the regime calculations, I mean, there is a strange and in some ways quite bloody dynamic. On the one hand, it's very much in the interest of regimes to lead their protesters to take up arms, not for the military to defect, but for pockets of protesters to shoot. It helps them in terms of their public relations. It helps them solidify the core of regime supporters who now see that protesters are threatening them with guns. And it helps them, as I said, justify their own resort to weapons. And they have more weapons and a great ability to use them than any combination of protesters will have. So that is the threat. And I think in Syria, the main challenge of the opposition is going to be to remain peaceful, even as we hear reports, and I think quite credible ones, of some groups within the opposition that are resorting to arms, that are shooting at security services. I think that is precisely what could undo or what could hurt and delay the transfer of power in a country like Syria. But then again, there's some members of the opposition who probably see it to be in their interest to provoke violence on the part of the regime because that's the best way to isolate it, that's the best way to trigger international condemnation. So at some level, both sides have an interest in seeing the other one resort to violence as a means of strengthening its own case. But in terms of the long-term effort to topple these regimes, the trap is to resort to violence because they cannot defeat regimes through military means. Again, I would say Libya is an exception because they have NATO at their side, but without the intervention of a foreign power, it's very hard to imagine that armed protesters can overwhelm military apparatus, military regimes that have been built to confront armed threats. They've not been built to confront civilian uprising. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Robert Malley, Dr. Robert Malley. He is the program director for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group. He's in Washington, D.C. We're talking about what has been going on in North Africa and the Middle East over the last 9 months or so, these events that some people have called the Arab Spring. Not everybody, I think, is happy with that terminology or feel that it really describes what's going on. But if you say that, people, I think, will know what you mean. Mm-hmm. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. There, as you have said, there have been cases where in the particular places there has been involvement and intervention from outsiders. In some cases, like Bahrain, for example, it was neighbors. The Saudis and United Arab Emirates sent in troops, forces that were used against demonstrators there. But there's certainly no more dramatic example of outside intervention than Libya. And you also, one might wonder, if you take a look at the two places where the crackdown against protest was and opposition was the strongest, the two places would be Libya and Syria. Syria, a place that probably was known for a long time as being one of perhaps the most, with the exception of Iraq, maybe the most iron-fisted regime in the region. And I suppose you could also make the argument, given how many people have died in Syria, for some kind of intervention by the international community there, other than just verbal condemnation. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, as you set those two cases side by side, how one thinks about making the case for NATO's involvement in the one place but not the other.
I mean, you know, it's difficult. In the case of Libya, it was almost the perfect storm in terms of the perfect conditions for international intervention. Number one, it seemed that the rebels, the opposition, had a territorial foothold that they needed to protect, and the justification for NATO's intervention was sort of to protect that enclave. And you could do it physically by simply preventing any Libyan troops or aircraft from attacking Benghazi, the eastern part of the country. It also was an intervention that not only had Western support, it had the support of the Arab League, it had the support of the United Nations. I mean, it was hard to find. Even though in private many countries were mumbling and weren't that happy, but there was no real public protestation. So this was an international intervention, very unlike what happened in Iraq several years ago, and it was one that you could at least rhetorically define in very limited humanitarian terms. It was not to overthrow the regime. It was to protect civilians in Benghazi. Of course, as some of us had feared at the time, there's mission creep, and it very quickly becomes more than simply protecting civilians, and now there's no doubt that the mission of the NATO forces is to topple Colonel Gaddafi. That's when it becomes murkier. That's when it becomes more controversial. That's when it drags on the way it has. But it's true. I mean, if you look at it, there's no doubt that NATO's intervention helped save lives. How many lives we'll never know. That's a counterfactual one can never really prove. But it certainly, there's no reason to doubt that it saved lives in Benghazi. In Syria, it's not clear that you have. I mean, it's clear that you don't have those circumstances. You don't have the kind of international consensus, and you certainly don't have a clear-cut situation where forces would come in and say, we're going to protect citizens of where? Of Dera, of Hama, of Homs, of Latakia. I mean, every city now is both the scene of an uprising and the scene of regime brutal repression. So short of a military intervention a la Iraq, where you'd come in and say, we're going to overthrow the regime, and I would hope that nobody's contemplating that, particularly given the experience of Iraq. Short of that, it's not clear what military intervention can do. So, of course, it's frustrating. It's even depressing, I'm sure, for the people of Syria and for people who care about the people of Syria. But I don't see a military answer, and unfortunately, short of a military answer, I'm not sure what the international community can truly do other than to continue to build pressure on the regime.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Libya, do you think that it is possible for the anti-Gaddafi forces to win outright, or would we have to be looking there at some kind of negotiated peace that might even, although I think a lot of people would be really unhappy with the idea, might even make it possible for Colonel Gaddafi to remain in Libya?
You know, the organization that I work in, the International Crisis Group, from day one, we advocated a negotiated solution, knowing that it was very hard, it might not even be achievable, but that it ought to have been given a more serious try, and that rather than have as a precondition that Gaddafi had to leave office and then we would discuss the conditions of a ceasefire, his departure from a position of power should have been the end goal that everyone agreed on, that there should be a transition to a regime in which the Gaddafis no longer played a role. Today I think more people agree that they're going to have to find, unless he's killed, which may well happen, but people are now, as we talk, as we speak, thinking of negotiated solutions, all of which would entail Gaddafi's departure from power. I mean, there's no debate about that. That's going to have to be the outcome. The debate is whether he's able to stay in Libya or not, and it's not clear that there would be many places where he could flee if he's not in Libya, and whether he would have to leave power before there were an agreement on the ceasefire and on the transition itself. And those are what I suspect the members of the opposition and the members of the regime are negotiating right now. Might be overtaken by events. I mean, this is a situation where, as every day goes by, Gaddafi has fewer munitions, fewer fuel, and fewer money, and the opposition has more of all of those three. So it could be one of those cases where, with time, the regime simply collapses. Then we'll have to see how you rebuild Libya and whether the antagonisms and rivalries and resentments that have been built up over the last 6 months can be quickly overcome.
We have a caller here. We'll get right to it and invite others. Our guest in this hour, by the way, is Robert Malley, Dr. Robert Malley. He's Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group in Washington, D.C. Again, callers are welcome. They'll help us by being brief. That way we can get in as many callers as possible. But certainly calls are welcome. We'll go to Effingham for a caller. Line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, David. I always take the tack that we have to look at the historic aspect of what your guest is talking about. The Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, and all the other people in the Middle East, in Africa, around the world, those leaders were bought by the U.S. or Western Europe, use them until they're used up, and then when some uprising comes, the guy goes aside, or win or lose, like you just said, things will remain the same. And if you could explain how that occurs, and how it even happened to the U.S. in prior to 1776. I mean, the paradigm, to me, is always the same. And until you change the paradigm, nothing will change. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, if by the paradigm we are talking about the fact that the West, and not just the West, supported the very regimes whose fall they're now plotting, I mean, the call is absolutely right, and that's something we're going to have to reflect upon, and because it's still the case today that we're supporting regimes that we know to be authoritarian, we know to be undemocratic, and we know that someday or other the people will rise up and demand change, and we have to weigh that against our immediate strategic interests and stability and the free flow of oil and in good relations with regimes that are in place. But that has been a pattern, and you know the other pattern has been that we end up reaping the sad results of what we've done. And if you look at Afghanistan, if you look at Iraq, we've tended to support situations that then end up coming back to haunt us. But that and you know, for all the talk today that we are revisiting the way we are conducting our policy and putting values ahead of immediate material interests, that's true up to a point. We still have very close relations with countries in the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia, even though we know that they are not, they don't share our values, and we have the same when it comes to China, when it comes to other countries, and it would be naive to say that we should simply, you know, throw all those old relations aside, and become solely interested in the promotion of democracy. But those are issues I think that we're going to have to continue to weigh, because right now we have to overcome decades of resentment that have been built up in the Middle East, of course because of our policies on the peace process between Israelis and Palestinians, but also because of our support for regimes. Again, as I say, somewhat hypocritically, we are today applauding their collapse.
Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I would like you, if you could, to talk a little bit more about Egypt there, what has been going on there. And it would seem that, again, that's one of these places where initially there was great hope for change, particularly among young, progressive, secular people. And while there has been apparently a great growth in political activity and political parties, it also seems to be that the military that are now ruling the country are pretty irritated with these young progressive secularist types, and think that they're sort of punks and that they wish that they'd just be quiet and go away now, and that it seems that what they're doing, that is what the governing military council is doing, is going out and seeking to make connections with, to look for support from perhaps the most conservative and least progressive mm-hmm. elements in Egyptian society, perhaps with the idea that some kind of coalition can be built up, and that would actually end up limiting the amount of change that ends up taking place by nudging out those people who are interested in the most change happening.
I think, first of all, there's a general historical comment that revolutions do tend to devour their children, and I think it's not just the case of what we're seeing in the Arab world. If you go back to the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and very often the people who are the most enthusiastic in the streets are not the ones who end up collecting the spoils, because they're less organized, they're less determined, they're less ruthless. And you often see more organized movements that take over afterwards, and the people who are in the streets are left wondering and scratching their heads about what happened. But that's quite universal, unfortunately. I think specifically in the case of Egypt, there also has been sort of I think the media, or at least Western perceptions, created two somewhat distorted pictures. One was that Egypt was enthralled by the Facebook generation, that they were the ones who were leading the revolution, that these young, as you say, secular, liberal, sort of Western-oriented by their culture, people were the ones who were leading the revolution, and therefore the ones who would take over afterwards. That was one image. The other image, which we read constantly in the press, was to celebrate the fact that they were not burning Israeli flags, they were not burning American flags, and therefore this was a different kind of revolution that didn't care about foreign policy. All it cared about was democracy and restoring freedom. Both of those are highly exaggerated. The bulk of Egyptians probably don't recognize themselves in the young, more Western, more cosmopolitan, more technologically adept Egyptians. They welcome what they did, they applaud what they did, but that's not truly who they are. And so I think it's normal that after the revolution takes place, most Egyptians are gravitating towards those who they know best. And the Muslim Brotherhood, the movement I assume you're referring to when you say that the military might be seeking an alliance with more conservative groups, the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamist organization, is one, among others, that is going to emerge strengthened, even though they were not as visible during the uprising itself. But they have deep roots, they're well organized, they have a message that resonates deeply with many people, and they're not the only ones. The other point, the other piece of this, is that I think we're going to see in Egypt and elsewhere a stronger emphasis on foreign policy to the detriment of our own positions. I think you're going to see a country like Egypt be more active over time in promoting the Palestinian cause and promoting Arab causes, even if it means alienating the U.S. That's going to be, because part of what these uprisings were about, even though it wasn't that visible on our television screens, was Egyptians rising up against decades of what they saw as excessive subservience to the West, that Egypt wasn't taking the lead in Arab affairs anymore, that it stood passively by when Iraq was occupied, that it stood passively by when Palestine was attacked, that it stood passively by whenever anything happened that affected the region. And inevitably, if you're going to have regimes that are more representative, more authentic, these are going to be regimes that are going to be more assertive in terms of what their people want, and what their people want is often not going to be what the U.S. Administration is going to want to see.
Well, I think this is interesting, because I think that some people have made this observation that one of the features of again, this wave of change that we have seen is that people haven't been out in the street burning American flags. That is, it doesn't, and you might expect that there might be more of this, but that there didn't really seem to be at least a strong anti-American bent to it. Now, maybe it had a somewhat strong anti-Western bent, which it's sort of the same and yet not. What can one say, I guess, about how people feel about the agenda for the region that not only the United States, but maybe also the major players in Europe would have?
I mean, both what you're referring to, in my view, are correct points. I mean, these were not led, these uprisings were not led by antagonism towards the U.S. They were led by alienation from their own rulers. Mm-hmm. And in a way, these were the second movements of independence. They had their formal independence or their formal sovereignty from their colonial masters. Now they really wanted to rule themselves as they saw that their own rulers were accumulating wealth and accumulating power in an increasingly narrow circle of the elite. So these were internally generated. But it doesn't mean, as I said, that ultimately it won't result in policies that are more assertive and therefore more independent of what the U.S. and others have wanted to see over the years. And we're going to have to learn to adapt to that, and hopefully we'll learn to do it in a way that won't be focused on trying to change them and to force them and to punish them if they take these more assertive positions, but to work with them and to defend our interests even as they're going to defend theirs. And for those who, you know, I think Egypt ultimately will have a foreign policy that is more akin to Turkey's today, which is still close to the U.S., a member of NATO on top of it, but every now and then will defend policies that are contrary to what we would prefer to see. But that's ultimately much healthier than to have regimes that we are close to, that pursue policies that we are sympathetic to, but that don't represent their own people, and that, in fact, are very much at odds with the feelings of their people.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Robert Malley. He's Program Director for Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group, and we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
This month, maintenance work is being performed on our AM580 antenna. It'll make our signal more reliable, especially during inclement weather. At times when the work is in progress, we'll need to reduce our power, and some of you may have trouble receiving AM580 as clearly as usual. 90.9 FM will not be affected, and AM580 is always available online at will.illinois.edu. Thanks for understanding.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Just to mention quickly that in hour two today, Celeste Quinn will be here in the chair talking with Dr. Mark Gronin. He is a geriatric psychiatrist, and she'll be talking with him about some of the things that he deals with in his new book, How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. He writes in this book about the many things that he has learned about aging from his patients. Then tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, I will talk with Pat Shipman. She is a Professor Emerita of Anthropology at Penn State, and we'll talk about some of the ideas that you will find in her book, The Animal Connection, which takes a look at how it is our connections with animals, with other animals, relates to our own humanity. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. You can look at the schedule and listen to past programs by going to the website, which is will.illinois.edu. In this hour of the show, our guest is Dr. Robert Malley. He's the Program Director for Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group in Washington, D.C. He directs analysts that are based in a number of countries, in Jordan, Egypt, in Lebanon, in Israel, and also in Iraq. And together they report on the political, social, and economic factors that affect the risk of conflict, and then make policy recommendations to address those threats. And we're talking about some of the political changes that have been going on here over the last few months, going back to the beginning of the year and just the end of last year in North Africa and the Middle East. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. I wonder if you could say a couple of things about Yemen. Here it was a place where, again, the government was met with demands for change. The president said he would step down, and then there was this attempt on his life where he was seriously injured. And since he was taken to Saudi Arabia for treatment, and since then has been in Saudi Arabia, and it seems to be unclear when or even if he comes back. What do you think is likely to happen there?
I mean, I wish I could say, and one of the things I should have said from the beginning is that I had not predicted what happened in Egypt or Tunisia. So to try to predict what's going to happen now, it takes a little bit of I mean, that's all a matter of speculation. I think, I mean, Yemen is, each case is similar and each case is extremely different.
Sure,
and what's amazing or fascinating is to see both the uniqueness, but also how each case is affecting the others and how leaders and protesters are learning almost like two chess players from earlier rounds that other people have engaged in. What the president of Yemen seems to have learned is, from the example of Tunisia and Egypt, is you don't let go. I mean, you stay on, you fight, because once you leave, not only does it mean you're no longer in power, but look at what's happening to President Mubarak right now, you know, humiliated in a courtroom where he's behind bars, where he's on a sickbed, and being questioned by some of the people, ironically, that who owe their positions to him. And that's something I think President Assad in Syria and President Saleh in Yemen have taken to heart. So he doesn't want to give up. He has sons and nephews who he's hoping could take the reins after he leaves. And he hopes that by lasting, he can outlast his opponents, create a sort of divide-and-rule kind of strategy. It doesn't look particularly good for him, not just because he was wounded in this attack. He's now in Saudi Arabia with uncertain prospects of return. But the balance of power within Yemen itself has shifted against him. As you said earlier in the presentation, parts of the military, important parts of the military, have defected to the other side. None of that preordains the outcome. I mean, and again, it's become so murky because the original protesters are now seeing elements of the regime siding with them, but almost in an attempt to hijack their own revolution. So who will come to power at the end of the day could simply be another part of the elite that was disgruntled, that was dissatisfied with President Saleh, and members of his tribe who had disagreements with him. So you may see a reshuffling of the deck more than the kind of revolution that the young protesters wanted. And in that sense, the individual fate of President Saleh is important, but is not critical, because what really will matter is not only whether he leaves, but what kind of political system will emerge after his ultimate departure. In other words, once he really resigns from any pretension of coming back, which today he's saying that the current president is still only sitting in for him until he returns. I'm saying even when it's decided that he will not return at all, people set him aside, the big question mark then will be, what happens to Yemen? Who comes to power? And as people know, Yemen is a country that not only had this uprising, it also has a secessionist movement in the south. It has an uprising, a religious-based uprising, with religious overtones. It's not entirely religious in the north, and that complicates the situation and makes Yemen a real powder keg.
Hmm. It seems to be I certainly take your point that one has to be very cautious about making predictions, and the other that each country, there is something about each country that's a little bit different. And while people have grouped together what has these events, and for reason, they see them as part of a kind of a larger picture that you have to take each country as an individual case. What seems to be the case, though, is that if we have seen these demands for change in a lot of these places, and pressure put on governments, and in some cases, some governments having to bow or at least bend to that pressure. What also seems to be becoming much more obvious are clear divisions among people within these countries, divisions that existed before, certainly between rich people and poor people, between Sunni and Shia, between one region and another, between various kinds of coalitions and alliances and another. A lot of very serious fracture points that seem now to become more obvious or maybe more problematic because of the kind of pressure being put on governments.
You know, I said earlier that one of the ironies of revolutions is that the people who come to power are not those who toppled the old regime, and that's one of the paradoxes people now have to live with. Another one is what you're mentioning now, which is these revolutions, particularly in Tunisia and Egypt, were remarkably unified. I mean, you didn't see people talking about differences between Copts and Muslims in Egypt or between social classes or other such divisions. But the more these things drag out and drag on, the more those differences, which appear to be sort of overcome, are resurfacing, not just in countries surrounding Egypt, and we're seeing that in Syria between Alawites and Sunnis. We're seeing it in Yemen between the different groups that I mentioned earlier, certainly in Bahrain between Shiites and Sunnis. But in Egypt itself, the problems between Islamist and more secular forces, the problems between Copts and Muslims, these are societies that have had some of these problems, and the revolutions for a moment appear to sort of erase them. But they're there, and as economic problems get worse, as insecurity gets worse, as uncertainty rises, there's at least a good possibility that those divisions, those fractures within society, will also become stronger, and it's going to be another one of those great challenges for the whatever political structure takes place or emerges in the future to try to deal with them. Mm-hmm. But it is striking how the unity that appeared so remarkable only a few months ago is now fraying, and you're talking about a region that has seen a lot of secessionist movements and fragmentation, whether in Iraq, among Palestinians, in Yemen, in Sudan. So this is a region that is, because of the artificial boundaries and the legacy of colonialism, that is not immune to those kinds of movements, and I think we're seeing it more and more now. Mm-hmm.
There were two, in the region that we're talking about, two very large, powerful, influential countries where there are movements for change, or at least people who would like to see change happen, where the two governments have managed to really clamp the lid down. And the places I'm thinking of are Iran and Saudi Arabia. And in Iran, so they clamped the lid down with really serious force. People will remember the demonstrations that broke out after their last presidential election and how the government responded. In Saudi Arabia, the government responded rather differently by, in a sense, they handed out money, is what they did. They're trying to bolster, you know, keep people quiet and bolster support for the regime, essentially by passing out economic benefits, which I suppose can go take you some way, but only go so far. Particularly, I'm interested in what you think might be likely to happen in Saudi Arabia. Again, given I appreciate your earlier comment about not being able to predict the future, but what one might look for in that country.
I mean, I've liked to refer to some of these countries as the dogs that haven't barked. I mean, you mentioned Iran and Saudi Arabia. There are other cases that, if things were to happen, they could be of extreme importance and extreme challenges to us. Think of Jordan, think of Palestine and Israel. But you're right to focus on two of the ones that are now emerging as sort of pillars of the regional order and as real competitors in the regional order, Saudi Arabia and Iran. Saudi Arabia is a country where, objectively, there are many conditions that could lead one to believe that it could be unrest. Economically, right now, they're doing well, but the level of unemployment is high and is predicted to get higher. And they don't have the means to create employment. It's also a repressive regime. They have tried to co-opt segments of their population, but it's been accompanied by also a clamping down. And they have a Shiite population, particularly in the oil-rich eastern regions, which has felt discriminated against for some time. It also has a number of assets. It's a monarchy that has some religious or strong religious legitimacy. It has the money that a country like Egypt or like Syria, like Yemen, didn't have to try to buy off and satisfy the material grievances of their people. So for me, Saudi Arabia remains a question mark. It's not a very open country. It's not a country I've been to that often, so I want to be very careful about making predictions, even about countries that I travel to a lot. But Saudi Arabia is somewhat of a mystery, at least to me, because one could make the argument that it is close to some kind of explosion, but I could also see very strong reasons why it will remain stable for some time to come. And I mean, among the reasons for the possible instability, which I forgot to mention, is a looming succession crisis. The very old current generation of leaders without a very clear line of succession, and that will open up a whole host of questions. That was one of the, not key, but one of the tangential issues that affected the situation in Egypt. An aging leader who wanted to put his son in the presidency, or at least there were speculations of that effect, mm-hmm. and that opened up a whole host of questions about what kind of country people wanted to live in. That may well happen in Saudi Arabia, but I personally would not bet on the country exploding anytime soon, but I don't want you to replay this tape to me in 6 months' time and proved to me how wrong I was.
Well, we have been talking about here some of the places that have gotten the most attention over the last few months, Tunisia and Egypt and Yemen and Libya and Syria. But at the same time, the kinds of things that we're talking about have been going on in, it, I suppose, at least a dozen countries, maybe more. Are there some other places you think where things have happened that are particularly interesting or noteworthy or one should sort of talk about or know about that actually haven't gotten the degree, the amount of attention that these other places have?
Well, I mean, people do tend to focus on countries where bad things or exceptional things happen, and there have been some other, you know, case, you know, look at a country like Jordan has had sort of a brewing unrest, but so far, both, you know, for a number of reasons, the makeup of the country, the divisions between the Palestinian and the Transjordanian population, perhaps the legitimacy of the monarchy, it has so far been under control. Morocco, another country where there were signs of unrest, and then the king did something that others haven't done, which is to try to preempt it by instituting his own relatively far-reaching constitutional reform, certainly not close to what many would like to see, but more than others and sooner than others, and to that extent he may have been able to at least gain a substantial amount of time. I look, if there's one place that I look at and I think is worth focusing on, not necessarily because anything is imminent, but because if something were to happen, it would be a real game changer, is in the Palestinian-Israeli theater. And, you know, many Palestinians who view themselves as being having been historically at the vanguard of the Arab people, sort of the vanguard of their struggles, are now looking and saying, what's happened to us? Everywhere else in the region, people are rising up against their domestic rulers who are autocratic, despotic. We not only don't have, you know, we have reasons to rise up against our own rulers, but more than that, we have domestic rulers. We have reason to rise up against foreign occupation. And yet they haven't. Now, many reasons for that, and I'm not saying that they ought to rise up, but I think it's a question as to at what point do Palestinians decide that they too need to go down the path of, say, massive civil disobedience, massive protests? How does Israel respond to what would be a very critical challenge to its own security and its own future? How does the United States react if Israel came to try to suppress a peaceful uprising? Those are questions that will, of course, not only have an importance to Palestinians and Israelis and to people in both places who are aspiring to a better future, but also to the rest of the region, to the United States, the balance of power in the Middle East. It hasn't happened, it may never happen, but it is a place, I think, that is worth watching and asking ourselves, why hasn't it happened? I mean, right now we're seeing hundreds of thousands of Israelis rising up over discontent over their social material conditions in Israel itself, a remarkable sight, which is not that analogous, not analogous to what's happening in the Arab world. They're not demanding the toppling of the regime. They're demanding reform and changes to their living conditions. But it is remarkable to see that happen. So far among the Palestinians, we haven't seen it. It's been relatively quiet. And I'm simply asking the question of how long that will last.
Mm. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus. Just again, quickly, I will introduce the guest, Dr. Robert Malley. He is Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group in Washington, D.C. And questions are welcome. Someone wants to call and get in quick, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk at illinois.edu. Just for, again, something I sort of want to come back to. You know, I think that when things were really breaking in Egypt, people were saying, "Well, who is there in Egypt that's already positioned to be a force in Egyptian politics?" And so a lot of people looked at the Muslim Brotherhood because they were the most organized opposition party, even though I guess officially they didn't really exist, or they weren't allowed to exist in the country. So that's why people thought, well, Muslim Brotherhood would, at least they had some organization. And there was a lot of concern there and has been concern elsewhere about the possibility of, Islamist parties becoming very influential and Islamic governments, perhaps. I suppose that the big fear is that somehow there would be another country that would end up being like Iran. Can one say something about the the influence of political Islam in what has happened so far?
Yes, I think. I think first of all, we should try to disabuse ourselves of, or not believe in one of the two extremes. I mean, these countries are not going to become like Iran for a whole host of reasons. They're not also going to simply ignore Islamism and the notion that people had during the uprising that Islamism had no part of it. I think, as I said earlier, was mistaken. These are countries in which the Muslim Brotherhood, in particular, but other Islamist movements, have deep roots and strong resonance, and it is almost inevitable that as the societies become more open, they will play a greater part. And they're going to play a part, particularly in Egypt. I think they're not a majority there. They're probably not a majority anywhere. But they are a plurality, or at least the single strongest organization, certainly in Egypt, potentially in Syria as well. Strong role in Libya. I think that's, you know, people are going to have gone through many experiences in the middle in the Arab world. They are now going to be more open to testing Islamism, not in an Iranian mode, not as a hegemonic, monopolistic form of power, but in combination with others, in coalition with others. I think we're very likely to see the Muslim Brotherhood and other brands of Islamism play a big part. It's going to be a challenge for the West, for the U.S. in particular, to learn to live with Islamist forms of government, or at least Islamist-influenced forms of government. And it's going to be a real challenge for Islamists over there to try to reassure their domestic constituencies and international audiences that they are not what the stereotypes of them have made them out to be. Mm.
I want to try very quickly to get in a caller here in Champaign. You'll have to be quick, caller, but please try to go ahead. Line one.
I have two quick questions.
We probably only have time for one. Let's just have one.
Bring them up and you can choose. One is, I wondered if you'd talk about Turkey and Syria and Turkey's attitude towards Syria's, you might have spoken about this already, Syria's repression of protests. And an alternative is also to talk about, are there any, protests about Hamas's form of government and form of political repression in Gaza?
And unfortunately, Dr. Maley, I can give you about a minute.
Okay, I'll be very quick. There are some forms of protest in Gaza. They're not as widespread as elsewhere. And many Gazans, on the other hand, say that, you know, sort of forgive Hamas by blaming the conditions that are being imposed by Israel and the rest of the world. When it comes to Turkey, I think you're right to put your finger on that. It's a country that has close relations with Syria. It's been very close to the same regime. I think the calculation the Turkish government is making now is that it has long-term interests with Syria and the Syrian people, and not with the Syrian regime, and they have begun to hedge their bets. I think they are soon going to do more than that and be more clear about the fact that they believe this regime is going to have to go because it has not lived up to its promise and it has missed every opportunity it had to reform.
Well, I'm sorry to have to make you go so short there, but we are just at the end of the time. Our guest in this hour of Focus, Dr. Robert Maley. He is the program director for the Middle East and North Africa of the International Crisis Group based in Washington, D.C., and certainly they do have a website. If you're interested in their activities and what they have to say about what's happening around the world, you can go there and look at their website. And Dr. Maley, thank you very much for giving us your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
We're on the web, WILL.illinois.edu. You can listen that way through your computer. We're streaming live there. Also, that is a way for you to go back and listen to past programs that you might have missed first time around. They're there on the website. And also that way, you can consult the schedule and find out what we'll be doing in the days to come. That's all at WILL.illinois.edu. And, of course, there's a lot of information there available on what happens on our other stations, WILL-FM and WILL-Television. Right now, we'll take a break, as we usually do at this point, and we'll switch around hosting chores here. Celeste Gwynn will be with you for hour number two, and she will be talking with Dr. Mark Agronin. He is a geriatric psychiatrist and has written the book How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. He'll be talking about some of what he has learned about aging from his patients. That's in the next part of the show. First, though, we'll take a break, as we usually do, so we can bring you an update on the commodity markets and some news from National Public Radio, so stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at how futures are trading at mid-session. It's been very quiet for the most part in Kansas City and at the Chicago Board of Trade, although wheat has been the leader in Kansas City to the upside, as well as Minneapolis wheat. Along the trading pits this morning regarding spring wheat contracts due to concerns about the quality of this year's crop, as weather forecasts are projecting a return to hot and dry weather in the U.S. plains, which could then potentially limit the size of this year's spring wheat crop at harvest. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. In Kansas City, September wheat at 820 up 9, March 855 up 8,